From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. You're with Misty Winston on today's News Talk Radio, TNT. TNT.
Hey, friends, this is the Misty Winston Show right here on TNT Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in. Yes, go to the shop. Go get you some merch. The shirts are awesome. That's all I have personal experience with, but definitely go get you some shirts. So, and also, I have good news. Well, I don't know if it's good news, but it's news. Apparently, unless something happens in between now and tomorrow, Reporters Without Borders is going to be visiting Julian Assange in prison. This is huge. He has not really had any visitors outside of immediate family and lawyers, obviously his legal team, in years. So this is a pretty big deal. So Christoph Delawar and Rebecca Vincent, who I'm familiar with Rebecca Vincent. I, for some of you who may already know, I host the Action for Assange vigils on YouTube and Rockfin. And we have had her on our show several times to talk about the Julian Assange case and other attacks on press freedom globally. So she is going to be going with Christoph tomorrow to visit Julian Assange. So this is from the media advisory that was released by Reporters Without Borders today. It says, on April 4th, Reporters Without Borders Secretary General Christoph Delawar and Director of Operations and Campaigns Rebecca Vincent are scheduled to gain rare access to Belmarsh Prison to visit WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange. They will be available for comments to the media before and after the visit. RSF's representatives have been granted permission to visit Assange 1 week before the four-year anniversary of his imprisonment in Belmarsh, a Category A men's prison in southeast London, where he has been held since 11 April 2019. They will be joined by his wife, Stella Assange. Assange has not been seen outside the prison walls since 6 January of 2021, when his request for bail was denied in a hearing at Westminster Magistrates Court. Since then, he has only been permitted to attend court proceedings remotely via a video link from Belmarsh Prison. No photos or videos have been permitted of Assange during these 4 years, including during his wedding to Stella Assange in March of 2022. Assange has received only a handful of visitors in prison beyond his immediate family, who also did not have access to him for a period of 8 months during the pandemic. Among his previous visitors prior to the pandemic were actress Pamela Anderson, rapper and singer MIA, Greek economist Yanis Varoufakis, and Australian MPs Andrew Wilkie and George Christensen. RSF will be the first NGO to visit Assange in prison. Delawar has previously visited Assange on 3 occasions during his period at the Ecuadorian embassy in London prior to Assange's forced exit from the embassy and subsequent arrest. Vincent leads RSF's global campaign to free Assange and monitored all stages of the extradition proceedings against Assange from the public gallery in London courts from 2020 to 2022. Journalists are invited to speak to Christoph Delawar, Rebecca Vincent, and Stella Assange outside of Belmarsh Prison at 11:15 a.m. and when they will give a statement following their visit and take questions. Delawar and Vincent will also be available for comment before entering the prison outside the gate from 8 to 9 a.m. Interviews are possible in English and French. Okay, so it looks like from 8 to 9 a.m. in London tomorrow, outside of Belmarsh Prison, they will be Christoph and Rebecca will be available for comment briefly before they go in. It looks like their meeting with Assange is scheduled to take place somewhere around 9 a.m., maybe shortly after. And it looks like it'll be going for potentially a couple of hours. They said that they'll be done around 11:15 to answer questions following that. So this is a very big deal, as I said. And I do this. Like, this is what I do. I am an activist, a free speech activist, press freedom activist. I've been heavily engaged and involved in the Assange case for years. And it just occurred to me when I read this media release that he has not been outside the prison walls since 2021. All of his court proceedings, everything that he has attended since then has all, when he's allowed, because it's very often he's not even allowed to attend his own court proceedings via video link or whatever. So the idea that he has not been outside the prison walls since January of 2021 made me immensely depressed. So as I mentioned, we are coming up on the four-year anniversary of his arrest. As I've been talking about, we are holding an event in Washington, D.C. outside the Department of Justice on Tuesday, April 11th from 4 to 6 p.m. We are going to be calling for his release, the immediate dropping of the charges and his immediate release. We also have seen members of Congress led by Rashida Tlaib start a letter to the Department of Justice asking them to drop the charges based on the threat to press freedom. So that is very late. It's 4 years. 4 years he's been in prison. Been held on remand, not even with any charges. And we are just now starting to see members of Congress even say his name. I mean, it's taken this long for them to even just say his name. So Rashida Tlaib has signed on. I think Jamal Bowman, Ilhan Omar, I think AOC has said she plans to sign on. I've been trying to get Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie, Matt Gaetz, and others who have been vocally supportive to sign that letter. We'll see if they're willing to put their differences aside with the quote unquote progressives. I don't put any real faith or stock in this letter, but it can be used by us as Assange activists to garner more support and attention for the cause. So use it how you can. Use every opportunity, right? So this is going to be interesting. I'm very excited to see how this plays out. I'll definitely give you an update on it tomorrow. I'm very excited that somebody that I have somewhat of a trust level with Rebecca, is going to be visiting him in prison and can give us some information about how he's doing. So definitely tune in tomorrow and I'll give you an update on that for sure. And don't forget, you can follow me on Twitter at Sarcasm Stardust. I'll be tweeting out regularly about the Assange case. And I also have a Substack, mistywinston.substack.com. You can find a write-up of every single guest every day here on the Misty Winston Show that includes links to all of our guests, different projects, so that you can go and support their work as well. So definitely check that out. And while you're at it, why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all the major social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. And you can help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
The news and talk you need.
It's more than just opinions, it's facts.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right. Our guests for the hour are Maria Hartwig and Mark Fallon. I'm very excited to talk to both of them. So Maria is a professor of psychology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice at CUNY, where she has been on the faculty since 2006. She is co-founder and co-director of Project Aletheia, a collaborative knowledge hub on interrogation at John Jay College. Her specific scientific expertise is in the psychology of interrogation and the related topic of the psychology of deception. She's produced research with the support of and in collaboration with various government agencies and entities, including law enforcement, the Department of Defense, and the High Value Detainee Interrogation Group, which is also known as HIG. Hartwig's work on strategic interrogation techniques is widely disseminated and is incorporated in the training programs of the HIG, within federal law enforcement training programs, and in practice on state and local levels. Mark Fallon is the director of Club Fed Strategic Services and a visiting scholar at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He is a co-founder and co-director of Project Aletheia. Mark is a leading expert on interrogation, criminal investigations, and counterintelligence and counterterrorism operations. He has led some of the most important counterterrorism investigations in recent history. He has hybrid experience stemming from serving as a career Naval Criminal Investigative Service NCIS and special agent, and deputy assistant director, a member of the senior executive service within the Department of Homeland Security, an international security consultant, and past chair of both the High Value Detainee Interrogation Group Research Committee and the International Association of Chiefs of Police, International Managers of Police Academy and College Training Section. Ooh, that was a lot. You guys have a lot of credentials, my friends. Maria, Mark, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us, Misty. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm very excited to talk to you both for a couple of different reasons. One, in my work as an Assange activist, I've become very familiar with things like Guantanamo. And I'm also a true crime nerd. So I'm very excited to talk to you about many things. I'm going to try to keep it as organized as I can. My brain is jumping around and wanting to ask you a million questions. But let's start with, how did the two of you come together? And maybe you can tell us a little bit about Project Aletheia, what the goal is. Maria, do you want to start?
Sure. And thank you for getting the pronunciation right, by the way. Not everyone does.
I usually do not.
Well, there you go. Project Aletheia is aimed essentially to bridge the gap between the science and practice of interrogation, because what we're currently looking at in the United States and in other parts of the Western world is a state of affairs where the practice of interrogation is pretty far removed from the state of the science, meaning that there are shortcomings in practice. There are ways in which the practice of policing and interrogation in particular can be improved. And our vision, the vision that Mark and I had for forming Project Aletheia, was to accelerate the implementation of science by having practitioners and researchers in the interrogation arena join forces to collaborate, to work on research, to exchange knowledge in order to better the system for more effective techniques that are based in the in ethics, law, and science.
Yeah, and Mark, you have a really interesting perspective coming into this, given you know, your history and your credentials. I mean, you've kind of seen these things from you know, all angles. What do you think is the most what's troublesome, I guess, worrisome aspect of the way that we're currently doing interrogation? I know that we say interrogation. A lot of people have a bad taste in their mouth about that word because it kind of has been lent to a meaning of torture. You know, they started calling torture enhanced interrogation, which I think was partially responsible for that impression that people are getting. But I think that across the board, we're seeing in law enforcement and then also, you know, and things like Guantanamo, we're seeing a completely fact-free approach, an anti-science approach to interrogation, you know, where they're using deception and they're using torture tactics and things like that. Is that what you would say is the most troublesome aspect? And are we kind of starting to see where people are? I mean, with Project Alethea, I think that, you know, you're kind of building this group out where, you know, we're starting to see more people understand that this is the approach that we're taking is not helpful at all.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there, Misty. You know, in 2000, five and six, a report came out from the Defense Intelligence Agency called Adducing Information. And it was a very revealing report because it was commissioned by the Office of Director of National Intelligence under President George W. Bush because of all the bad information that we were getting out of detainees. A lot, not just torture, but due to inept practice, poor training by military interrogators, Guantanamo filled with people and that should not have been there. And so the government was trying to study why we were getting all of this bad information. And that report disclosed that it had been more than 50 years since the government had put any substantial research into why someone would talk to somebody like me in an interrogation. And that kind of cascaded to when President Obama took office. And what he said is in 2010 or 2009 and 10 that we will not torture anymore. He issued an executive order 13491. But what he said was that we need to determine the best methods to obtain accurate, reliable information from the greatest threats to our national security. And in 2010, when the Hive A Detaining Interrogation Group was formed as the entity within the United States government that would interrogate the highest value targets, I became the chair of the research committee and part of a wave of over 100 research projects around the world and studies to help enable us to get more accurate, reliable information. Now that's the really good news about that is that there's been research. We now know things we didn't know before about how to obtain information from someone who's in custody and someone who's not in custody. That data, that information is being very effectively used within some federal law enforcement agencies. I was the assistant director for training of the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. Their training curriculum and policies have evolved, and now they only teach science-based methods. I was the director of the NCS Training Academy. Their training policies and practices have evolved. They now only teach science-based methods. The Air Force Office of Special Investigation only teaches science-based methods now. The challenge we have now is that that information, that science, that evolution of practice has not effectively trickled down to the state and local level. And so we're still having a lot of departments who are actually utilizing techniques that are getting false confessions, that are getting unreliable information, that are getting bad data. And so that's really the challenge now is, and that's what Project Alethea is trying to do, is really bridge that gap so that law enforcement officers are better informed of the evolution of the practice so that they can bridge the gaps within their communities. And that's one of the problems we're having in policing now. We're having trouble with recruitment and retention of police officers. Community has lost trust in police. And so what we believe is that if we start now again policing with virtue, and that we start doing the right thing again, we start using science, we will rebuild that type of trust that is necessary in policing in a democracy.
Yes. And I think that it's important that people realize that this is, it's decades of bad behavior, and that's not going to change overnight. And if we are going to seek to reform, which I'm not convinced that the policing system, the law enforcement system in this country can just be reformed. I feel like it may be, like you said, trust is completely lost. We may need to find a way to develop new systems in conjunction with the, you know, getting rid of the old systems. And I don't know what that looks like. I'm not smart enough to know what that will look like. But I do think that there's been decades of trust being lost. And I think it's going to take time, not only to rebuild that trust, but also in order to do that, to, as you said, reteach and retrain and re-educate law enforcement officers across the country. That's going to take a significant amount of time. And I think that that's what Project Alethea is seeking to do. Okay, we have to take a really quick break, but everybody hang tight. We're going to be right back with more from Mark and Maria right after this here on TNT Radio.
State of the Nation on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Parents' Bill of Rights wins zero votes from Dems, who attack it as fascism, extreme attack on schools. Our House Speaker McCarthy rips extreme minority party after no Dems support Parents' Bill of Rights. Now listen. Parents have rights, their children, parental autonomy. This is just another example. We pay taxes. We do not want to co-parent with the education system. We are in control. Parents are angry. Parents are unhappy. I just gave a workshop two nights ago. The room was overflowing. The parents want answers. The parents want help. They want to do this alone. They don't want the interference. They want their kids reading, writing, and arithmetic. And we know the Dems always go straight to, okay, you're a racist, or, you know, you're a fascist, you're a white supremacist. That's what they do. It's ridiculous. And I am so happy to see parents and caregivers stepping up, reclaiming their children, demanding answers, and they have every right to know what the curriculum is, the books being used. It's a no-brainer. So I say good for all the parents, good for everybody starting to make some noise and demanding answers.
State of the Nation on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Lorry from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
Hunter Biden, where are you hiding? House Republicans are looking for you. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
All right. This is TNT Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm joined by Mark Fallon and Maria Hartwig, and we are talking about Project Alethea. And Mark, right before the break there, you mentioned Obama, and I wanted to ask you specifically about his 2014 comment where we tortured some folks, right? Very famous. Everybody was frankly kind of astonished that he was so kind of dismissive about what he was saying, as if it didn't really matter or whatever. And he also said that we need to look forward. What do you think about that? Because I feel like in this situation, accountability is not only warranted, but needed. It is desperately needed if we seek to shift the culture in this country and shift the conversation away from things like that. So what do you both think of that? I don't care who goes first, but to me, that just seemed like a big red flag in terms of the United States, you know, maybe being willing to admit where they've gone wrong, but not being willing to hold anybody accountable for it.
Yeah, well, I'll give you my views, then I'll let Maria take over and give you hers. So President Bush sanctioned torture. President Obama, with his look forward, not backwards policy of impunity, gave torture sanctuary and then it let Trump celebrate torture. And right now, to a certain degree, President Biden is ignoring it. We still have people at Guantanamo who have not been brought to trial. There's still the motion hearings 20 years after the attacks of September 11th and the USS Cole. So it's been more than two decades since those attacks, and people have still not been brought to justice. And the reason is because we keep trying to throw this cloak of invisibility over anything that would shed any accountability over those who have tortured or advocated for torture. So Maria, why don't you go on from there?
Well, I have nothing to add in terms of the Obama issue, but I think the broader issue of accountability within the system is tremendously important when we talk about interrogation. Not only when it comes to law enforcement, but the prosecutorial system as well. And I think it's well known by now. There are thousands and thousands of known exonerations where people have been convicted of crimes they did not commit. And it doesn't take that much calculation to figure out that these miscarriages of justice that we know about through post-conviction DNA analysis only represent the tip of an iceberg of a problem that the legal system has. And one of the problems is that there is currently a very limited mechanisms of accountability for misconduct. So that is a problem that we're mindful of. I want to circle back a little bit to something you said before the break, Misty, that you expressed some sense of despair about the prospect of reforming the police. I understand completely where you're coming from. You see police shootings of black and brown young, mostly men, all the time. It's hard to imagine, perhaps, that things can be bettered. But I think if you present practitioners with tools that are effective. So what we're putting in front of practitioners is not some kind of huggy, squishy tea and crumpets sort of way. Very often harsh interrogation is contrasted with that tea and crumpets kind of approach, yeah, as if those are the two only alternatives you have. Either beat the hell out of a person or be completely dim-witted and benign. What we're talking about are methods that are strategic, the methods that are about outsmarting people who are trying to deceive you, methods that are designed to provide pathways for innocent people to explain their innocence. So when you talk about the type of techniques that the science has produced, these are not necessarily things that police officers think are silly. Actually, they're not. And in the departments that have embraced them, we get a tremendous amount of positive feedback because these techniques work. They clear cases. They exonerate innocent people. They help the conviction of guilty people. So in some sense, if you can tap into the pragmatism of the police, if they're interested in solving crime, then it's in their best interest to embrace methods that produce better outcomes.
Yes, that is a very good point go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't lose hope. We see more and more pockets of excellence in policing. Marie and I have traveled around the country meeting with police departments. We're in discussions now with police departments who want us to come out and give them training in these strategic methods that we have. And we're seeing more and more of this. Los Angeles Police Department has revamped their training. We're in discussions with departments in the Midwest. We've gone to places like Charleston to see how they're doing policing. LaGrange, Georgia, the improvements they're making in Baltimore Police Department. So there's incredible pockets of excellence. We just need to see more of those, and we need to see people embrace the science. Here's the problem. The old methods that they utilized were effective in obtaining confessions from guilty people. However, they're also effective in obtaining confessions from innocent people. Yeah. When we teach them these science-based methods, they get more information, more accurate, reliable information, less false information, and more admissions. And so we're not taking tools away from police. We're taking away their antiquated tactics and replacing them with science-based methods that are more effective. And a lot of police aren't realizing that when they are going after the wrong person, the perpetrator remains on the street preying on their communities.
Yes.
And they don't know that till years later after these exonerations.
Yes. And we've heard of many of such cases where there's been a wrongful conviction based on, you know, a false confession numerous times. I mean, just unbelievable amounts of cases of that happening. It's kind of incredible to me that there are so many. The Innocence Project does a fantastic job of trying to find those kinds of cases and flush them out and then, you know, fight for those people who they think have been wrongfully convicted. But yes, it is. It's very frustrating. And Maria, what you just said, I think, is important because, you know, how people think that it's either you have to be, you know, have to be beating the crap out of somebody or you have to be, you know, like you said, tea and crumpets. I think that so much of that comes from our movies, like the good cop, bad cop. Like that's the way that we've always been kind of shown that that's how policing work. And I think that that's done, you know, that's really kind of helped shape people's viewpoint of how policing works and how interrogation works. And there's always the one guy who's super nice and super caring and, you know, wants to give you a blanket and some coffee and let you have a cigarette. And the other guy wants to beat the crap out of you. And so that's, I think that's very interesting to think about the idea that the way that the policing and interrogation has been presented to us in media and the way that that has shaped public opinion. So we're going to take a quick break and get some headlines, but hang tight. We're going to be right back right after this here on TNT Radio.
Welcome, welcome.
Coming up, important news.
TNT Radio News.
And that's the truth.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. All eyes are on New York on the eve of former President Donald Trump's historic court appearance in Manhattan. Italy has blocked access to OpenAI's chatbot in the country due to privacy violations, and there are reports German states could be set to follow. And Japan has backflipped and started buying Russian crude oil above the agreed price cap that had been set by the West and agreed to by Tokyo last year.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
All right. We are joined by Maria Hartberg and Mark Fallon from Project Aletheia. And I wanted to talk a little bit about, I know we mentioned it briefly there right before the headlines, but false confessions. I'm fascinated by this. As I said, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I'm a true crime nerd. So I literally watch all of the things. I love watching interrogation analysis videos where they interrogate the different tactics that are used and things like that. But what do you think is the most what is the cause of a false confession? What are these tactics that you're talking about that police are using that are most effective in kind of getting those false confessions out? And what are I also want to ask too on that. Are you seeing most law enforcement agencies being receptive to the changes that you are presenting, or are they kind of, I know change is difficult, or have they been kind of, you know, aloof about it?
Well, Mark, do you mind if I take a step?
Yeah, go ahead, Marie. You take this one.
Well, perhaps you can speak to the reception aspect, but in terms of the psychology of false confessions, you can group the risk factors into situational risk factors and individual risk factors. So people bring certain psychological characteristics into the interrogation room with them that render them more or less vulnerable. For example, youth. Young people are more suggestible. Young people are more likely to fall for tricks that the police are currently in most jurisdictions allowed to pull off. Things like mental disabilities, alcohol, drug intoxication, they all diminish a person's ability to withstand coercive interrogation. But it's really important to understand that false confessions can happen to people who are fully mentally capable. And the trick lies in the particular methods that the police use. And I could go on and on about this because it is a fascinating science. You can understand it through a kind of social influence persuasion lens, whereby the police officers, they emphasize the consequences of a denial that the consequences of denying are bad. You're just going to look bad if you keep lying to me. And lying is equating, you know, denial is equated to lying. And they rely heavily in these classic coercive type of approaches to something called on something called minimization, where they basically make it seem like not such a big deal. We've all done things that we regret. They frame the act in question as an accident, perhaps. Now, their police are not allowed to explicitly promise leniency. So they're not allowed to say, if you confess, you get a lower sentence. But what people hear through pragmatic inference, when they hear the event being framed like the police do using these tactics, is that maybe if I just sign this piece of paper, I get to go home. And that is, of course, a naive notion. But so this is a kind of con game. And the police that use these methods, I've seen hundreds and hundreds of these tapes where they're salespeople, and what they're selling is something that the person doesn't want to buy, but doesn't know that they don't want to. So it's really a fallacy to think that only crazy people do this. In fact, normal people respond to this kind of pressure by simply yielding. And it's very normal to think that, okay, even if I do sign this piece of paper so I can get out of this room where I've been in for 16 hours or what have you, I'm going to be believed later, because who's going to look at this confession and think that it's true? I my innocence is clear. So in essence, to go back to what I said initially, it boils down to vulnerabilities within the individual that vary, but then also factors that the police can push and pull around that lead people to think that giving an admission is their best course of option, when in fact it never is.
Yeah. And Mark, have you had most people be fairly receptive? I know people, some people who are in law enforcement, and I know that those that institution is very kind of set in its ways. I mean, for example, they use the Reed technique that's been around since like the 50s, I think. And I know a lot of these interrogation tactics and investigation methods have been in place for decades. So have you noticed that they are kind of receptive? You would think, as I think Mark, you said earlier, you would think that they would be, given the fact that you have empirical evidence that the methods that you are approaching them with would be more effective. But I also know that it can be really, you know, like I said, change can be difficult.
Yeah, the problem isn't convincing them this is more effective, because once we give them the training, it's quite apparent that it is. The challenge is getting them to the training. The challenge is that police aren't recognizing this is a problem. Right now, they're under fire for, rightly so, for de-escalation tactics, right? At the scene of the arrest. And so they're under tremendous pressure, because that can be seen on videos. What's the challenge is, what happens when you re-escalate in the interrogation room when people can't see what's happening? And even if there are videos, you're using psychological pressures to try to get what you think happened, not what actually happened. So the challenge isn't once we get them into the training. When I took over the NCS Academy in 2008, we were not using science-based methods in our instruction. They are now, right? They've learned, science has evolved, they've embraced it. The director of NCS came out this past summer and said to the field, I don't care how you've trained before or what you've used in the past, from this day forward, we will only use science-based interviewing techniques in our practice. When I took over as assistant director for training of FLETC, they were not using science-based methods in the way they were training a majority of federal law enforcement officers in this country. Today they are. So they have embraced the science. The practice is evolving. They're going out with export training to Dallas PD and other departments. Departments are yearning for this. They just don't know they need it yet, because the problem is with these exonerations, they happen years after the event. And so while there's someone with a cell phone on the scene and you can see the police officer who may be using excessive force, The people who've got these wrongful false confessions may not know for a decade later. And so there's no accountability for them. They've gone on in their careers. And the challenge is, this is their identity, right? A lot of people who became chiefs now at one time were investigators, and they feel that they're excellent interrogators. They very well may be, but it's haphazard. And you just don't know what you don't know. And so I'm really encouraged when I see these departments embrace the training, because once they get it, they evolve and they really try to improve the practice. So I'm really encouraged with what I see. I just don't see enough of it.
Yes, I understand that. And I think that you're right. I think that that's probably a little bit to do with the fact that they are under so much pressure for so many other things. And so it is going to be, especially given the fact that I think they're having a staffing issue of extreme proportions. And so it's probably difficult for them to even, you know, get enough people to work a shift, let alone have the time to send everybody to training. Because, I mean, this is obviously going to take many training hours to kind of get these tactics down and to kind of unlearn what you've learned and relearn something new. I think that that's always difficult for anybody. And I think that you're right. I think a lot of people who, you know, may have been taken part in provoking a false confession have now moved on, and there is no accountability. And I think that's a real problem, is that, you know, we see all these cases of people getting out of prison, you know, 18, 20, 37 years after being wrongfully convicted. And there's never any accountability for the people who worked on those cases. And I think that that's a real problem, because I think accountability is a big thing for me. I think if you mess something up, then there needs to be, there needs to be some justice. And I think that these people who get out, you know, they might get a little bit of some restitution or something, but there's no accountability for the people who might have coerced them into these false confessions. And I think that that's a real problem. Okay, we've taken another quick break. Everybody hang tight. We're going to be right back with more right here on TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
So the left and their media buddies have become the new defenders of the Jewish people, calling out anti-Semitism whenever and wherever they see it. No, that's not what's happening. Example, recently the head of the ADL went on CNN to discuss a new survey on anti-Semitism, and there was not one mention of Kanye West or Kyrie Irving. It's always Donald Trump and the right that are guilty. And if you dare mention that billionaire George Soros contributes to left-wing causes, and specifically that he helped elect left-wing DAs like Manhattan's Alvin Bragg, you are also an anti-Semite. Forget that Soros contributed almost $180 million during the 2022 election cycle, according to OpenSecrets.org, or that CNBC says he gave another $140 million to politically charged nonprofits in 2021, or that Fox News reported that Soros pushed $1 million to the Color of Change PAC, which backed Bragg's candidacy. If you dare mention any of these facts, you, my friend, are a left-wing certified anti-Semite. Well, like they say, takes one to know one. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
A social credit system was introduced in China in 2014. China's social credit system is a nationwide government program for regulation of citizens' behavior based on a point system. Under this system, citizens are assessed using data collected from court documents, government or corporate records, and even from neighbors and observers. Citizens with higher scores are eligible for bank loans, free medical checkups, and other services in demand. Points are deducted for traffic violations, defaulting on loan payments, smoking in non-smoking zones, buying or playing too many video games, posting false news stories online, and other transgressions deemed appropriate by authorities. Citizens with bad social credit scores can be denied essential services, and blacklists are available for employers, educational institutions, and credit providers to reference. When introduced by China's State Council, it was announced the system would favor the trustworthy to roam everywhere under heaven, while making it hard for the discredited to take a single step.
Cutting through the clutter, this is the Misty Winston Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right. We are joined by Mark and Maria from Project Aletheia, and we are talking about interrogation techniques, which is something that I have been fascinated with since I was a kid. I mentioned the Reed technique earlier, and to me, I wanted to ask because to me, that seems like a very blanket approach. You know, you create a high-pressure environment, and then you know, I feel so bad for you, and you offer help and all of that, but only if you get a confession, and that seems like a very blanket approach. Would it make more sense, and has your research shown that it's better to kind of tailor make your approach to each individual? Because like Maria just said, each person, each individual is different and will respond to, I mean, I think we know that just in general in life, I think people respond differently to different approaches and to different tactics and different conversational, you know, approaches and things like that. So is that kind of what you're seeing? Is that, and I also, do you think that you're able to get a better information, more accurate information through not necessarily kindness, but through respect? Mark, do you want to answer that?
Yes.
Or Maria, go ahead, please. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Absolutely yes to respect being a key component. I think kindness is effective as well. When it comes to the characterization of the Reed technique as a kind of blanket approach, it's a little bit more complicated than that. They're actually pretty articulate in the Reed manual and in how you should devise a particular kind of theme, where the theme is the main device that is supposed to elicit a confession, depending on the police officer's assessments of the suspect's personality, which is of course complete horseshit, because the police are not in a position to be able to make that kind of assessments.
Right.
So they have the superficial look of being tailor-made to the suspect's personality. From the perspective of course, it's important to be mindful of individual vulnerabilities, but in general, from a socio-psychological perspective, we're more interested in methods that work in general, that operate on mechanisms that are sort of scientifically anchored in our understanding of human memory, cooperation. So, there's another thing I really want to get out there. The Reed technique is a big brand, but I'm not convinced that they've really invented anything. They make a huge amount of money by unscrupulously mischaracterizing the literature and selling their manuals and their training. They've done a tremendous amount of societal harm. And I wish there was an accountability mechanism for them. But I think that what they've done is really, and you're correct, that they go a long way back at least to the 40s. And what they've really done, I think, is articulate and kind of trademark a type of mentality that already existed. So
yeah,
when I was talking about accountability here, about their spouting nonsense, I think I wish there was an accountability mechanism for multiple things that are being sold to law enforcement as tools for helping them solve crime. There is a tremendous amount of nonsense, pseudoscience out there that is being pushed to the police under the buzzword of being evidence-based. And this is another reason for the partnership under Project Aletheia, the partnership with practitioners and scientists, because I'm not a police officer. How am I? Like I'm not trained to shoot a gun or take down a person in a tactical situation. A police officer is not trained to tell the difference between a scientifically validated method. But that's what I'm here for, and people like me. So the point, one of the points of our enterprise is to, now that these terms, evidence-based, science-based, start buzzing around, to actually help practitioners point them to what masquerades as science, but is actually just nonsense, and what is proper, methodologically sound science.
Yeah. That is a great point.
That's the key also. When I took over and when I started the as the chief investigator for the military commission process after 9/11, the first thing we told our investigators was don't use Reed. Right. We are going to use rapport-based techniques. We know how ineffective that can be. We don't need bad information. We need good information to protect our national security. And so that's what we're seeing in the training. And when Maria and I train, we ensure that we are able to articulate the scientific principles behind what we're doing. We train in the strategic use of evidence. Retaining the cognitive interview. There are certain things we use. Orbit out of Liverpool, England. Lawrence and Emily Allison developed that technique there. The Sioux technique, which is probably the most widespread in the evolution of this new wave, was invented by Maria Hartwig and Paul Anders Granhag from Gothenburg University. So what we are doing is we ensure that we look at what the psychological underpinnings are behind the technique that we're teaching. The Sioux technique is a very good mechanism to detect deception. We teach the Scharf technique, a very good technique to elicit new information. The cognitive interview, a very good for memory. But we ensure that whatever that we are training is grounded in law, science, and ethics. And if police departments would just shift from a confession-driven model to an information-gathering model, where the goal isn't the confession, the goal is the truth, right? That needs to be the goal. When I worked the cases for the military commission, we had 780 people down at Guantanamo. They're down to about 30 now. You know what we spent most of our time on? Exonerating people. They didn't belong there. You know, people were saying, well you're not finding terrorists. That's because they're not terrorists.
Right.
That's a successful investigation. A successful investigation isn't the confession, it's the truth.
It's truth.
And if we could just shift that mindset and you apply the science, we can get back to what we, Marie and I, call policing with virtue again. Police need to be the good guys in that room. And when we do that, then we'll restore the trust with the community.
Yes. And that is such a good point, because it really is. And I don't know where it went wrong, but it really is now confession driven. And it seems as if the truth is completely lost, or completely, it seems as if it's something that's been made irrelevant. As long as you get a confession and you can close that case, it feels like that is the end goal. And that is so unbelievably depressing as somebody who pays very close attention to a lot of crime and interrogation. And the reason why I asked about the respect aspect of it, instead of, you know, badgering somebody or bullying somebody, or you know, in some cases being physical with somebody, I think one of the best interrogation, and I wouldn't even call it an interrogation, it was more of an interview, and it was beautifully done, and it was with the confession. I don't know if you're familiar with this case, probably you are. Colonel Russell Williams in Canada. I don't know if you've seen that that interrogation, but it was, I mean, maybe perfect. It was so well done, and it was done with complete respect. The police officer never, the investigator never raised his voice. He was never disrespectful. He was never rude. It was just honestly one of the best interrogation or an interview videos that I've ever seen. And I think that is, when I saw that, that's what made me really realize that the idea that you can bully somebody into giving you legitimate information, they're just going to tell you whatever you want to hear to get you to shut up, because it's scary and painful and all of those things. And I think that we've seen that time and time again. So hopefully, I mean, this information that you're giving to the law enforcement is going to sink into them. And that's what I'm worried about, though, is that it feels like the culture of policing is so broken in this country. And it's hard for me to see a light at the end of the tunnel when we're in it this deep. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're pretty bad. It's pretty bad at this point.
I do, but don't, give up hope. And let me just talk about that kindness aspect you mentioned. So the high bed detainee interrogation group conducted research, and they went out and they talked to individuals who did a lot of high value detainee interrogations, and then they did interviews of people who just did a lot of interrogations at the high level, and they asked the investigators and interrogators what they thought the most beneficial quality is for someone doing an interrogation. And the number one quality that other interrogators thought interrogators needed was empathy.
Yeah.
So that's a community who knows what they're doing, looking at themselves and introspectively saying that that's the quality, that's the trait. And that's what we teach, right? We're trying to teach
that's good.
How to be empathetic in there and to draw people out. Cooperation is volitional, right? The person needs to want to cooperate. It's not about getting someone to just comply to what you're saying, but you want someone to cooperate. You want new information. You want information that you didn't know before. And that comes from a rapport. And that's why we teach this.
Yes.
And the good and news that is
go ahead.
Sorry. The good news is even if you shift from a confession-oriented approach to what's often called an information gathering approach, you still get confessions. You might even get more confessions. There's a recent meta-analysis showing that the information gathering approaches generate fewer false confessions and more true confessions. So if you're hung up on that metric, which there's no good reason to be, but let's say that there clearly is an institutional hang up around getting confessions and confessions as a metric of interrogation success. But you can have your cake and eat it too, because the methods that are grounded in empathy, as Mark said, rapport, respect, they yield confessions, but you can solve crimes without getting confessions.
Yes, that's very true. And I think a lot of people forget that you don't necessarily need a confession. Is it nice? Of course it is. It makes your job a whole lot easier, makes the prosecuting attorney's job a whole lot easier. But you can absolutely solve crimes and get convictions without a confession. It happens all the time on a regular basis. And so this confession-driven model is completely unnecessary. And like you said, it's counterproductive, really. I mean, you're getting more false confessions than anything, and that doesn't help anybody. I mean, that, as you said, Mark, earlier, that leaves, first of all, an innocent person in prison and a guilty person walking the streets. And I don't think anybody wants that. Okay, so we only have about 5 more minutes left. So I want to make sure I can get your take on this, because I'm like desperately curious. What are both of your opinions on polygraphs?
Ooh, tough to answer briefly. It depends on the type of test. And I'd say the polygraph is extremely polarizing. People either say it's complete junk science, or they think it's the best thing since sliced bread. It's neither. The effectiveness of the polygraph test depends entirely on the soundness of the logic that underlies the test protocol. That's the best short answer I can give you. The polygraph test that is currently used in most police departments is very prone to misclassify innocent people as guilty.
Yeah,
that's problematic. But that the polygraph only measures stress, and that the only comparison that the polygrapher is making is between questions about the crime and sort of baseline questions, that's a mischaracterization of how the tests actually work.
So I think it's, I think it's an interesting science. It's an interesting, I think honestly, it'll probably, we'll be able to build on this as time goes on, and obviously we'll be able to improve upon it. It does seem, to me, it seems a little bit, I wouldn't say pseudoscience. I would say it's unsettled science, and I don't have a lot of faith in them. I definitely wouldn't submit to one. You know what I mean? Like, it's so easy to get, as you said, it's so easy to get mischaracterized as guilty as an innocent person. I mean, if you are, the problem with the fact that it measures stress is that you're already in a stressful situation. You're being interrogated for, whatever crime it is. You're, hooked up to this machine. You've got a police officer asking you all these questions. It's already a stressful situation. And so I feel like there's a lot of potential for false positives or false guilties there. So that's a little tricky. I just want to say, I love the collaborative effort of Project Alethea. I think that, as you said, cops aren't there. They don't know the psychology and all of that stuff. And you aren't a cop, and there's no way for you to understand what they go through. And I think that's why those collaborative efforts are so good, because it really gives a well-rounded approach. And I think that's so desperately needed, especially in this particular, on this particular issue. Mark, do you want to tell us where we can find you and where we can find Project Alethea? And then Maria, if you want to tell everybody where we can find you as well, that would be great.
Yeah, projectalethea.org is our website. It is really bridging the gap. We have practitioners and scientists. We connect them, and we make it free for them to join. We have a newsletter that goes out. We send it out. We have reflections from the field from practitioners. We have state of the science reports. We try to make it so it's understandable for the practitioner. And our whole goal is just to make the improve the practice of policing through science-based methods.
Excellent. Yeah. And Maria, where can we find you?
Well, you can also find me on our website, which is project-alethea.org. And you can find me on Twitter under Maria Hartwig. And you can also find Mark there under Glynco, G-L-Y-N-C-O.
Excellent. Thank you both for coming on. This was a fascinating conversation. I would love to have you both back. I could literally talk to you for hours because I'm like, my brain is swirling around with all kinds of questions I would have to ask you. So I would love to have you back. Thanks for coming on. I'll be back tomorrow with another show. As Julian Assange says, learn, challenge, act now. We are out of time. We got to act now. And don't go anywhere. Chris Smith is coming up right after this, right here on TNT Radio.